John chapter 15, starting at verse 1, where Jesus talks about being the true vine. I am the true grapevine, and my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch of mine that doesn't produce fruit, and he prunes the branches that do bear fruit, so that they will produce even more. You have already been pruned and purified by the message I have given you. Remain in me, and I will remain in you. For a branch cannot produce fruit if it is severed from the vine, and you cannot be fruitful unless you remain in me. Yes, I am the vine, you are the branches. Those who remain in me and I in them will produce much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. Anyone who does not remain in me is thrown away like a useless branch and withers. Such branches are gathered into a pile to be burned. But if you remain in me and my words remain in you, you may ask for anything you want, and it will be granted. When you produce much fruit, you are my true disciples. This brings great glory to my Father. I have loved you, even as the Father has loved me. Remain in my love. When you obey my commandments, you remain in my love, just as I obey my Father's commandments and remain in his love. I have told you these things that you will be filled with joy. Yes, your joy will be overflowing. This is my commandment. Love each other in the same way I have loved you. There is no greater love than to lay down one's life for one's friends. And you're my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you slaves, because a master doesn't confide in his slaves. Now you are my friends, since I have told you everything that the Father told me. You didn't choose me. I chose you. I appointed you to go and produce lasting fruit, so that the Father will give you whatever you ask for using my name. This is my command. Love each other. Amen.
Thank you, Douglas. So, I want us to work through this passage, and there's a few things I want to draw out. I apologize in advance if my thinking's a little muddled, but I'm teasing this one out, just being honest with you. Sometimes it's fully formed, sometimes it kind of forms as I'm sharing. But in a spirit of honesty, I'll let you know that. This is based around a message I brought on Thursday, but I was going to bring you that message, but it took a different direction, and I'll explain a bit more about that later. But Jesus is using this image of the vine, an image that had been used, the idea of a fruitful vine. I mean, it's in many places in the Old Testament. There's the parable of the vineyard in Isaiah. There's all sorts of, I mean, if you just stop to think about the imagery of the vine and think your way into a kind of Middle Eastern mindset. Vines are really, really important. They produce fruit that sustains, wine, of course, which is a brilliant way to preserve it. And just in case you're wondering, the wine that they drank was nothing like as potent as the stuff that we have. It was just a great way of preserving the crop and making sure that you got the best out of it. Israel's likened to a vine, and obviously that idea of fruitfulness, and of course you think about fruit and you're back in the Garden of Eden, you're thinking about, well, there's so much attached to this imagery that we can't do justice to just now. So when Jesus says, I'm the vine, I'm the true vine, I am the true vine, he starts within this passage. He's got his audience's attention. The disciples would hear that and understand its importance. I'm the vine, you're the branches. He goes on, of course, to say, my Father is the... the gardener, and he prunes every branch that produces fruit. And of course, he's saying this the night he's going to be betrayed. He's saying this on a night where they're going to enter into profound suffering. They're going to find that they're weaker than they had hoped. Peter's going to have the cock crowing three times. All of this mayhem will be happening in their lives. And he's saying to them at the start of this episode, my father prunes. Apparently, if you want to get maximum fruitfulness out of your vine, it's good to trim the branches, all of the care and attention that's put into a vine by a good gardener will increase its yield many fold, so I'm told. And that fruitfulness comes as a result of suffering. That's obviously what he's talking about here. Pruning is suffering. And if we think about our own lives, oftentimes if we've trusted in Jesus and we've made headway and things have come against us, there's been difficulty, and all of us in that situation at some point will ask the question, well, why? Why is it that I've gone through these hard things? And of course, it's not that God sends hard things our way, it's that he uses the suffering in our lives to help shape us and build character. And that's the pruning. But the other thing that we get from this is that fruit matters. It actually matters to your Father in heaven that your lives are fruitful. It matters. There's a faulty way of thinking about our lives in the context of God's grace, which runs something like, well, God's God, so he's going to do whatever he's going to do, and I'm just kind of along for the ride. Yeah? And we can all live like that at times. We feel like we're passengers on something that's preordained by God. And that seems to fit with certain ideas in the scriptures. But it's not actually what Jesus believes. Jesus believes that our participation as we co-work with him and work with his Father in heaven in the power of the Spirit, that actually is essential. It's profound. For us in terms of our character, it's profound for others in terms of how the love of God reaches. We know that the choices that we make can either benefit or harm the people who we know. We know this. And so fruit matters. We were made to be fruitful. Jesus goes on to say, remain in me. And I'll remain in you. Why? So that you may bear much fruit. Then he goes on to say, ask whatever you wish in my name and it will be done for you. Okay? Which is kind of like the theological equivalent of free minibar. Yeah? That's what it is. Free minibar. I've told the story before, but on our wedding night, we were at the Caledonian. I thought we might as well start as we mean to go on. And my father-in-law gave me a 50-pound note. This is 1990. I'd never seen a 50-pound note in my life. And I couldn't sleep that night. So I found myself looking at the minibar. There was a Toblerone. There were some nuts. You know, so drank all the soft drinks. It was great. So we're standing in the queue to check out the next day. And the person in front is settling up their bill. Did you have anything out in the minibar, sir? Oh, yes. And they run through the few things. I think it was 43 quid. And then when I left, I remembered that I forgot to tell them about the nuts. So I blew that 50 quid on the first night. It was a life lesson. But really what Jesus is talking about here is if you remain in me and I in you and my word remains in you, then whatever you ask in my name, that will be done for you. Ask for whatever you wish, it will be done for you. And it is, it's free minibar. What are we asking for? I was saying this is the bit that got Joseph's granddad. He was saying, yeah, because I said, if we gathered up all our prayers, the things we're genuinely praying for, as I was saying last week, what would happen? the sum total of our prayers, the stuff we're really trusting God for, what would happen? Or are we hedging our bets and just kind of hoping that God's going to do the right stuff and we don't have to take responsibility for it? But he says that because fruit matters. Who are you asking for? What are you asking for? 11:02 each day, who are you praying for? How's it altered your perspective? Friday's our day off, and I was getting ready to go out, and I looked across at Lloyd's the chemist, and there's Joe McCormack, who's our Bethany worker, who's doing the Bridge to Freedom project, and Alistair was standing with him, and it was like, oh, this is brilliant. We've got a recovered addict who's working with Bethany and a retired judge of the realm, and they're standing outside to talk to all the methadone users outside Lloyd's the chemist. It's just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful sight. And immediately I'm praying, oh, Lord, you make him fruitful. We're praying up there from the comfort of our bedroom. Lord, give him a fruitful time. I believe it was Alistair. It was a fruitful time. And isn't that fantastic? What are we praying for? What are we trusting for? Do we believe in a Jesus who can curry in someone who's recovering from drug addiction and put their life back together? Or someone who's locked in fear or depression or who's locked in a vicious cycle of materialistic greed and break them out of that and turn them into generous-hearted people? Do we trust? Are we praying? Do we ask in his name as we remain in him? Are we ready to bear that fruit? And that, of course, relates to last week's message. Jesus goes on, you keep my commands, you'll remain in me. You do what my word says, you'll remain in me. But in this, not only does fruit matter, but we understand that the way that we are related to Jesus matters. Now, how many of you have spoken to folks in recent weeks about doing Alpha or stuff like that, or maybe you're chatting with someone at Alpha, and the person says, well, I believe, okay? And you hear them saying they believe, but you just know in your knower that their relationship with Jesus isn't, that there's not a kind of intimate knowledge there. Anyone had a conversation like that recently? Where you're chatting with someone and... yeah, I believe, or someone said to Diane this week, I'm a God-fearing man. Wow, so it's quite a statement if you think about it. But you can't, you got that sense of, but that relationship isn't there. There's an awareness of the importance, and that's not to judge the person, they're just working with what they've got. But there's so much more for them. Yeah? There's so much more for them. They're kind of... to me, it's like they've got their nose pressed up against the window, reading the menu in the window, thinking, oh, I'd really like that meal, when actually there's a place at a table inside for them to sit down and eat the meal. And Jesus is talking about how he intends us to be related. And this is the other thing through John 15, which is really important. Remain in me and I'll remain in you. That relationship between us and Jesus is intended to be an immediate one. As someone once put it, God has no grandchildren. You know, if my mom trusts in the Lord, then God's our father. If I trust in the Lord, God's my father. I can relate to him through her, but that would be an inherited faith. And it's God's desire that that's turned into an own faith. And that really underscores much of the principle of how we work with children who have, and young people who have parents who are Christians. And obviously for many of you, and some of you found this for yourself, an inherited faith is of some value, but it will not sustain you through your life. And indeed, I believe in many of our churches, many of the people who are there have an inherited faith. They've got multiple generations of continuing in a certain sort of religious observance, which has a value. But it's not necessarily owned. You know, looking at the menu on the outside, even though they're at church. So it's Jesus' intention that our relationship with him is immediate. Now, here's the thing. When Jesus says, without me you can do nothing, is he speaking the truth? Now, okay, well. How many of us have managed to do things without Jesus over the years? Okay. We've all done it, right? But how's it worked out? What Jesus is saying here, not that you'll be incapable, it's not that you're going to be a couch potato watching Netflix all day. What he's saying is if you want to do stuff that really bears this fruit that I'm talking about, if you want to do stuff for me, stop. Because you can't do stuff for me unless you do stuff with me. And this is our problem. This is the Eden problem. When Adam and Eve realize that they've done the very thing that God has asked them not to do, what do? They hide. They hide. And then God says, Adam, where are you? And it's not because, you know, if God played a game of hide and seek, it's not really fair. Though incarnate Jesus could play hide and seek, I theologically believe that. But he could always ask his father for a hint. Now, I'm glad we settled that. So, that hiding, that desire to keep ourselves away, means that when we realize Jesus' love for the world, that the good news is genuine good news, we are tempted to go out and do it in our own strength. Now, how many of us have done that? Keep your hand up if that worked out really well. Good for you, Richard. So, we are not intended to do stuff for Jesus. We're intended to do stuff with him. And of course, we know deep in our deepest being, that means that our motives are laid bare, our successes and failures are laid bare, that he sees it all. And that is pretty darn scary. Just saying. But that is how he intends us to live. And I've spoken about it many times, but it's the with me life. And I come across people from right across the theological spectrum, you know, from sort of ultra-Orthodox evangelicals all the way through to people of a much more kind of liberal faith, who all struggle with the with me thing. They're trying to do stuff for Jesus. You know, they'll hear the thing on the Sunday and they'll go off and try and do it. And they'll maybe even pray about it. But they don't have that sense of, as I have that conversation, as I help this person in need, as I think about, do I have the energy and the emotional resources to interact with this person who's on my doorstep or who has sent me an email or a text? Am I capable of doing it? When we're making that, when we're having that discussion inside, are we involving Jesus in the conversation? Have you got me? I am absolutely exhausted. I don't have anything more to give, but you got a well. You see what I mean? And we self-protect and we self-protect and we hide. So John 15 is a statement of the with me life. And he goes on, as the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. How much does the Father love the Son? That's something that we can only see in part. It's why it's important that we sing. Because when we sing, I mean, Keith was leading us today, and when we sing and engage, something of that opens up. It's why great artists, you know, this wonderful building, whatever it may be, things just give us a glimpse of how much does the Father love the Son? The Father loves the Son beyond anything. We'd be in pieces. if we knew. Jesus says, that's how much I've loved you. Now, of course, the wee footnote is that John could have written, and we were incapable of experience or understanding it in its full state, you know. And we are, aren't we? We're broken. We do. We hide. We retreat. We self-protect. We have those moments where we are struggling to just open ourselves to the love of Jesus. But Jesus says, this is how he intends us to be related. This is what the with Jesus life looks like. As the Father has loved me, so I love you. Now, that's expressed in this, that I lay down my life for my friends. And he is preparing to do that. And of course, we'll say, no one has greater love than that, than they lay their life down for their friends. And you might think, well, technically, maybe laying down your life for your enemies would be tougher. What is Jesus about to do? He's about to do the thing that Paul would describe. While we were still sinners, while we were yet enemies, Jesus lays down his life for us. That's Romans 8. It's exactly what Jesus does. But actually, for that group of disciples, it was more important that they lay their lives down for one another. Because there was going to come a time where Jesus' presence with them would be by his Spirit, and they had to love one another as we have to love one another. Now, here's where things took a turn for me. I was with a group of people yesterday, and a conversation was had. I'm not going to say who or divulge the contents of it, but there was a conversation had about the importance of vulnerability in church. The importance of vulnerability. Have we got any vulnerability fans here? Good for you. Hands up who's not sure about the vulnerability thing. You know, it's kind of like, I remember a guy saying it was that the intimacy is like into me see. You just have a look on the inside and it's kind of like, we wear clothes for good reason. Okay? Vulnerability is essential in that with me life. The with me life is essential to bear fruit. Without vulnerability, we cannot love one another. We can't. Some of us work in workplaces where there's no need to be vulnerable at all. We do our job. Here's what you do. You do your, and it's boundaried. And for many of us, that can be quite reassuring. And that all works just fine until someone comes in with a teary eye or whatever, and you find out there's been a relational breakdown, or someone's died, or the people you work alongside and operate alongside, they're as open to the dangers and difficulties of this world, or more so, when you've been through some tragic thing and you go to work, and the people you're working alongside, how will they respond? If we can't be vulnerable in church, then he can't abide in us. We can't remain in him. We can't be fruitful. And of course, truly, we can't love one another. By the same token, there's a power in vulnerability. And the power of vulnerability is this, that if we choose to be vulnerable, if we choose to be vulnerable, then extraordinary things can happen. Was having a, I've said this a number of times recently, so it must be true. Only one person was paying attention to that. This is one of my fat opinions I've been working on over a number of years. I think the toughest thing for any church community to have is joy. Joy. I've attended many churches where we will sing about joy. We'll read about joy. We'll talk perhaps on the odd occasion about joy. But not an enormous amount of joy is experienced in the room. And here's why. Because joy is that irrepressible delight in one another that is not dependent on circumstances. Okay, so it's not happiness. It's something that's and actually the way that you discover if a church is full of joy is if when you get there on a Sunday morning, it's kind of, oh, it's so good to see you. That there's that it's kind of like a long lost friend. Oh, no, I haven't seen you since last Sunday, or maybe two Sundays ago, or whatever. There's just that joy of being together. And not only that, there's that expectation that we're going to encounter Jesus in the whole process, because we're going to meet him in each other at the very least, and who knows, he might do something in our midst, and we'll experience joy. And Jesus, in this process of talking to his friends on the night he was betrayed, is saying, fruitfulness matters. I'm the vine, you're the branches. Go bear fruit, but you can't bear fruit unless you remain in me. And that is the intentional relationality of how it's intended to be, the with me life. And if you do that, remember, he's standing on the cusp of his death. He's about to be tortured and rejected and shoulder up the sin of the world. And he says at that point, do this so that my joy can be in you and that your joy may be complete. Is true joy possible without vulnerability? I don't think it is. Let me tell you why. We cannot be truly known, typo. I'm being vulnerable. Some of you are wondering if I did that on purpose. No, I did not do that on purpose. We cannot be truly known unless we are willing to know and to be known. Yeah? We cannot be truly known unless we're willing to know and to be known. Do we allow other people to see us as we are? Do we allow other people to express who they are? Or do we put pressure on ourselves and others to conform to certain patterns, which mean that that stuff gets hidden? You might call that, I don't know, Sunday best. Not that you don't want to get dressed up to worship. I get that. Good for you. Some of you look very smart this morning. Others of you look very comfortable. Not at all. I'm somewhere in between. But unless we're willing to be known and to know, we can't truly know one another. And if we can't truly know one another, can we love one another? Can we? Really? You can do very kind things for strangers. You can. You can be loving towards them. But to really love them, you've got to know them. And there will be people who you'll know better than others, but it's just that willingness to be vulnerable. Jesus said, you did not choose me, okay, just in case you're going to get all Arminian and it's all free will, but I chose you. Sonny does a wee cheer. Good predestinarian text. And I shall appointed you to go and bear fruit. Fruit that will last. The stuff that you do with me, okay? So that whatever you ask in my name, the Father will give you. And this is my command. Love one another. Love one another. Love one another. Be vulnerable with one another. We've got a problem in our society at the moment that agreement is taken as, you know, you give worth to someone by agreeing with them. Yes? Like, share, you're right, they're wrong. But that's not love. Love is where you can profoundly disagree with someone, but love them just the same. Because the value I place on you is because of who you are and whose you are, not what you think. And as all of us who have children know, and all of us who are married know, and all of us who are children know, it's possible to love someone without actually even liking them that much in that current moment. Yeah? Some of you are having a laugh. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Where would I start? So, if we're prepared to be vulnerable with one another, then we don't necessarily have to agree. Unity is a product of the work of the Spirit in our midst, but we might not have unanimity. We might not all believe the same stuff or think the same stuff. And God made us different on purpose. Just saying. So John 15, do it with me, be fruitful, and be vulnerable. Now, is it safe loving other people? Some of our biggest sorrows and sufferings have been because we've taken a risk in loving others and it has not worked out. It is inherently risky. I would also say that not loving, not being vulnerable, that's also profoundly risky too, because it does bad things to us. But it is risky. But the thing is that when I take the risk and love, I make myself vulnerable. But to be vulnerable with others when I am with Jesus is different. You with me? You'll have all seen it in a romantic comedy or whatever, or a not-so-comedy, where someone declares their love for someone, you're thinking, bad idea. Bad idea. They've got that kind of, oh, it'll work out in the end. In our family, we call that magical thinking. Okay, that's magical thinking is where you go, oh, I'm not going to sort out that bit. It'll be fine. No, that's exactly the thing you want to sort out right now, because at some point in the next 5, 10, 15, 20, 50 years, that's going to come back and bite you really hard. You want to have that. There was an old thing, I'll change him when we get married. Never met a woman who said, that was a cracking choice of strategy. I don't know, that's enough. That's not a good idea. To be vulnerable and to know with Jesus is different because he underwrites our vulnerability. Do you hear me? Whenever we're vulnerable in Jesus' name, we are never alone. And the frightening thing about being vulnerable is we might be left exposed and alone. Yes? So vulnerability is possible in the power of Jesus, because he's always with us if we choose to remain with him. Alpha is an exercise in vulnerability, is it not? You do not know who's coming through that door. For all the group leaders and helpers and stuff, poor Kate doesn't know how many she's feeding. There's all sorts of challenges that are, you're inviting a level of chaos, which is frankly terrifying. And the only reason that we do that in faith is because we know that Jesus has got our back. Yeah. And you know what? He does. He really, really does. Alpha's an exercise in vulnerability. If it's not, it won't work. Because people won't truly get to meet Jesus. Last point. Remember what I said about being alone? Taking the risk? The last bit I want to do today is about Jesus' vulnerability. The book of Job is an ancient reflection on what would happen if a sinless person appeared outside of Eden. At no point does God or the friends of Job manage to pin him, I mean, he's not even a Jew, with something bad that he's done. And when his well-meaning friends say, well, you must be suffering as a consequence of some sin you've done, come on, let's have a look. And before you judge him too harshly, they've sat with him 7 days in complete silence beforehand. So until you've got 7 days worth of listening power, you know, don't judge him too harshly. But it would appear that the book is a kind of exploration. What would happen if someone who is sinless wound up in a sinful world? And the answer is, they'd suffer. They'd suffer. God'd have them, but they'd suffer. Here's Jesus. Was Jesus sinless? Did he enter into a world outside of Eden? Did he suffer? Was he alone? Was he vulnerable? On the cross, what protection did Jesus invoke? Paul quotes what is an ancient hymn or poem that was doing, I mean, the book of Philippians is, I don't know, the 60s. So this was written very, very soon after Jesus' resurrection. It says this: though he was God, he did not think equality with God was something he could cling to. Instead, he gave up his divine privileges and was born. He took on the humble position of a slave and was born as a human being. When he appeared in human form, he humbled himself in obedience to God and died a criminal's death on the cross. What's Jesus' cry of desolation? Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. My God, why have you abandoned me? Friends, that is something that we do not have to go through because he went through it for us. Therefore, God elevated him to the place of highest honor and gave him the name that is above every other name, that at the name of every knee will and every tongue declare that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Being vulnerable with one another can be scary, proper scary, but Jesus has underwritten it. And he called his followers into that life even as he stood on the cusp of his own abandonment. I can't tell you how wonderful he is, because we have never, ever experienced the fullness of it. That's the extraordinary thing about a life of discipleship. It's further and further up. So friends, be fruitful by doing it with him. And love one another as he's loved you, in the vulnerability of allowing yourself to be known and to know. And God will do extraordinary things. Through 2020, our mission as a church is to encourage everyone to live in the reality of Jesus' love. The Kirk Session believes that's what God's asked for us. That will involve a great deal of vulnerability. Even as we are fruitful, we will need to do it with him. Yes? Are we prepared to do so? Are we? May we pray.